Hello, my name is Jonathan Oxhorn from the Department of Architecture, Speaker of the Faculty Senate. I start with a land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayukono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayukono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy predates the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayukono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayukono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. Gavel in hand, call to order. We have an approval of minutes from December 8th, 2021. As you know, the minutes have been posted and distributed online in the form of a verbatim transcript. And so if there are any corrections, let me know now through raising your hand, either virtually or in person. And seeing none, by way of unanimous consent, the minutes are approved as posted. We now have Senate announcements and updates. Our first speaker is the Dean of Faculty, Eve DeRosa.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for those of you who are here and brave the sunshine to be here in person. I wanted to use today to allow for a lot of discussion, so we only have 5 minutes to just review a few things. This is our first meeting of the semester, and I unfortunately have to open with sad news. And so we have the sad news of Professor Stephen Beer, who was a previous Speaker of the Senate, who's passed away in our time between us meeting in December and now. And so for the colleagues who knew him well and for all of us, we'd like to just take a moment to remember him and his contributions to the Faculty Senate. And we have better news about another previous speaker of the Senate. And it's my sort of great excitement to announce that Professor Bruce Lowenstein is our new ombudsman. And we want to thank our previous ombudsman, Charlie Walcott, for all the wonderful contributions that he's made to the Cornell community. And we're looking forward to Bruce serving in this role and having the same level of wisdom that Charlie had for all of our constituents. I just want to let you know that the new general counsel for the university will come to the Senate and introduce herself, and it will be an opportunity for us to have a conversation with her, and so we're looking forward to welcoming her into the Senate. I just want to give some... It's almost like a curated list beyond what is on our agenda, but just to give you a flavor of the things that will be coming this semester that we're working on actively. Not everything, obviously, is on this slide, but I just wanted to give you a flavor of what we're thinking about. So the RTE task force is moving forward. We're hoping that they'll have some report at the end of the semester to bring to the Senate. But in parallel, I'm working with academic HR to give clarity to titles and the means for promotion and working on inclusion and sense of community for RTE and also the benefits for RTE emeriti. So there's many things to work through that weren't quite finished when we welcomed RTE faculty with voting rights into the Faculty Senate. So that work is happening. And I just want to open it up that we are still taking feedback from faculty on the honors and distinction proposal. We want to take that feedback in and have the VP UE revise the proposal if needed and then bring it to the Senate for a vote. But I just didn't want to bring it to the Senate without finishing the feedback. And I know, for example, the emeriti want to create their own summary of their feedback for the proposal. And so we are still welcoming feedback, and I just want you to know that. One of the pleasures of this position is that we have 12 Senate committees. And I wouldn't have expected that to be such a pleasurable experience, but I went around to each chair to understand sort of what their mission is and what they want to achieve through the position, and if there were barriers. And so I wanted to give you an example of one barrier that came through that process of me visiting basically with each Senate committee. And so the ROTC committee saw that ROTC students on campus are having an uneven experience. So in some colleges, their work with the military and the four branches of the military, they get credit for it. In other places, in other colleges, they don't. And so we're working with the vice provost of outreach and extension and also the committee to see if we can work with that that problem for our students. How am I doing on time, Jonathan?
2 minutes more.
Okay. Oh, I've got plenty of time. So a little intimidating meeting with the four branches of the military, but I did it, and we found a constructive exercise that we think can help the students on campus. And then the last thing I wanted to share is that the Global Hubs conversation is still happening as well. And so thanks to the resolution that we brought and approved, we have I have reached out to the Vice Provost of International Affairs, and we are working with Mark Milstein and the International Council. And the Global Hubs have these salons. And so the first salon happened last week. And out of that interaction, there's two new sites that may be coming up. And so I went to the VPIA just to say, let's bring the faculty in who are interested in these hubs, and they can present to the Senate, and the Senate can ask them questions. And so I've asked for some of the faculty who are interested in these new sites to come to the Senate hopefully next month. And so we can start the conversation before the hubs are actually created for why and how and what can be created through the global hubs. And that's all I have for today, and we're going to move forward to our agenda. We have committee reports on the part-time bachelor's potential, I guess, part-time program for non-traditional students. And so we're going to ask the Senate committee chairs to come up and give a brief report and then have the option for senators to ask questions.
Thank you. As Eve says, our next order of business is the discussion of part-time bachelor's degree for non-traditional students. I think we're starting with Mark Milstein, Management and Organizations, Chair of the Academic Programs and Policies Committee, I assume, in Zoom land somewhere. So unmute yourself if you're there, Mark.
Yep, he's there.
5 minutes.
Can you hear me now? Is that okay? Can I get a thumbs up if somebody can hear me? Good. Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon. Sorry I can't be there in person. I'm actually scheduled to teach right now. I've got my students out doing a project. So I just wanted to convey the summary of the CAP discussions on the proposal for the part-time program. And in general, you know, on the positive side, the committee was very supportive of the proposal, found it effectively addressed why Cornell would have such a program, in particular viewing it as consistent with the institutional goal of educating any person in any study, and also aligning with the changing market conditions that we can all see out there. That is the prevalence of non-traditional students that are seeking four-year university degrees and the competitive realities out in the marketplace where other institutions, peer institutions, are already responding to that market demand. On the other side of the discussion were concerns with the proposal. And in particular, that the proposal really, it was good on the why, but it lacked the discussion on the how. And in particular, there were really five issues that the committee ended up honing in on. One was prioritization and program decision making. And in particular, really thinking that there needs to be an emphasis on quality as a function of both content delivery and student support. Concern that a focus, an over-focus on, say, the financial viability and the profitability of the program could end up superseding some of those other issues and undermining the quality. The second was that quality of education, in particular, the need to really think through faculty and department engagement, given the participation of faculty who have the expertise, participation of departments where knowledge and expertise is housed for the different disciplines. It was seen as really critical for the success of the program. Third concern was around the methods of instruction. The proposal discusses that coming out of the pandemic, we know a lot more than we did about virtual instruction, and we can be successful at it. But there is limited. There are limits to the effectiveness of virtual and modular instruction, and that really ought to be taken into account overall if the program moves forward. The fourth issue was around scaling. The program as proposed seemed extremely complex with multiple disciplines being launched at one time. And there was a discussion over whether it wouldn't be better overall for the growth of the program to start simply and then build it out as success is understood. And the last piece was around accessibility of the program, that the types of students, the target demographics that the program would be aimed towards may not have access to the basic infrastructure necessary for an effective and an efficient learning program that's primarily virtual in nature. One of the things we did learn as an institution throughout the last couple of years with the pandemic is, while people may have some of the hardware necessary for connecting, without the proper internet connections, without the high-speed internet connections, the actual connection to virtual learning can be problematic. And so many of the demographics that are the target demographics for that program would likely be facing a lot of those infrastructure problems. So I'll stop there and take any questions that people have.
We'll have 5 minutes of questions after Senator David Delchamps talks. He's from Electrical and Computer Engineering and the chair of the Education Policy Committee, and he's right here in person in Schwartz Auditorium. 5 minutes, and then we'll have 5 minutes for discussion. Either one, either mic.
Am I close enough to the mic?
But stand closer.
Stand closer. Is that good? Okay, my name's David Delchamps, Electrical Computer Engineering. I'm the chair of the Educational Policy Committee.
Uh-oh. Whoops, sorry. Can you say that again? That I had a problem hearing you.
Okay, test.
I can hear you. I'm wondering if you can just repeat the question.
Oh, he thinks he's taking questions.
Mark, I'm not asking questions. Jonathan decided to have me report from EPC, and then people can ask questions to both of us. Got it?
Got it.
All right. It's weird. I'm looking at the screen. Okay. Let's start this over again. Chair of the Educational Policy Committee, and we met twice about this, and they were really good meetings, well-attended, animated discussion, et cetera. And I deliberately didn't read the report from CAP before I wrote up our report, and I was happy to see that there was a lot of intersection between the kinds of issues, especially the negative things that the two committees focused on and the tone with which they address them, but as that case may be, there are some differences. Okay, so first of all, we felt that the sentiment, the animating sentiment was excellent. You know, that we have, it's very praiseworthy and laudable to try to get some semblance of a Cornell experience that carries a credential extended to a population that now doesn't have a normal opportunity to go into a four-year residential program. And the populations they identified were, you know, compelling, interesting groups of people. And we have Cornell that has long experience with incarcerated individuals through the Cornell Prison Education Program. It's been going on for quite some time. A lot of good experience with that, and that was one of the demographics that were mentioned among the list of groups. Okay, and that's great. Okay, it would be great to do that. The one thing that we sort of thought, number one, what are these people going to get? Well, this is going to be a completely asynchronous virtual thing, okay? And our committee was unanimous in saying that asynchronous and virtual is, unfortunately, inevitably inferior to residential. Therefore, whatever these people get in terms of credential is going to have an asterisk. It should have an asterisk. And there was conflicting, info about whether the provost wanted an asterisk or wanted no asterisk after these things. But we thought it was very important that if you look at some of the other programs of higher institutions, for example, Harvard has a special degree that's awarded by and taught by people in their extension, their version of extension. And we're thinking that that's what this is going to look like. Okay, that's thing number one. Thing number two that we were a little worried about was who is it exactly for? Now, the groups that they mentioned in the, you know, the write-up at first, you know, the incarcerated individuals, children of migrant workers, mid-career adults who never had a chance to go to college, et cetera, you know, there's a lot of financial aid that's going to have to happen there. And where's that money going to come from? Is it going to ding the financial aid budget for the students here? And the provost said, no, this is going to be a closed system. The folks in this program who pay full price are going to subsidize the folks who need aid. Okay, so we immediately asked, where are the full price people coming from? These groups you mentioned here are not really full price type people. And the provost said that there's a lot of international folk who have a lot, have money and would love to have a Cornell degree. And so we were thinking, aha, so maybe that's what we should be thinking of, the wealthy industrialists from other countries paying full price, subsidizing the folks in the U.S. You know, we weren't really sure. We thought we had to settle that issue before moving forward with this. You know, what's the mix going to look like? And people were sort of scratching their heads and thinking, oh, what could possibly go wrong if you have, say, the crown prince of wherever says, I've paid, where's my degree? Well, you didn't pass enough courses. Well, fix that. You know, we were visualizing these awful things that might happen. Okay, so, but then again, this could all be worked out. Who knows? Okay. Another thing that we, so basically we were worried about, what are we doing for these people? That's the what. You know, is it going to be a degree with an asterisk from extension or not? Whom are we doing it for? Who's going to be in this group? What is the mix of people going to be? All right. And then how? How is this going to happen? And that, I think, is what Mark's committee focused on an awful lot, and we were worried about as well. The vice provost and his vice provost for undergraduate education, Lisa Nishi, has mentioned that there's a lot of online content available at eCornell that we could use right away in this program, and that's true. But there's not nearly enough for a program on the scale of what the proposal outlines. And creating such content is a huge time sink. Okay, it's a huge time sink. So where's that time going to come from faculty members? We already full-time, you know, doing our full-time jobs. That's a question. That's an open question. That's an important question. 1 minute? Okay, and so how are we going to do it? I think that's really important. And one other thing that I do want to mention really briefly at the end here, yeah, I didn't want to lay heavy emphasis on this, but committee members in EPC, a lot of us have experience teaching professional master students. I don't personally myself, but others did. Professional master students and others both at a distance and locally. And a lot of painful compromises happen when you teach those audiences. And really, a lot of the time you're thinking, you know, this is good enough. It's good enough. I'm going to bite the bullet and pass this person. You know, we would hate to see a situation where faculty members teaching in this program felt pressure, say, from the central administration to give a certain number of passing grades, even when they thought their standards were being compromised. And this is not to denigrate the folks to whom this program is directed, because, for example, the prisoners do better on plant science than our residential students do. But the prisoners have the bandwidth for that, and working adults maybe don't. So I'll leave it at that, and if you have questions,
thank you, David.
I'll stand here and...
Yeah, stand there. We're taking questions for 5 minutes. If you're on Zoom, please raise your virtual hand, and I'm looking at the computer to see if there are any hands. If you're in person, walk down to one of the two microphones, the one not occupied by Professor Delchamps.
I can move to the other one if you want to use this one.
Okay, I think we are supposed to start with Zoom, so Richard Bensel, you're first in line. Unmute and try to make it brief.
Two questions. Both are on admissions. So how are you going to... how is this? Everybody comes? I mean, what are the standards for admissions into this program? And it's a closed system. So you have to make it revenue balance. So you're going to have the revenue balances. Are you going to have weaker admission standards for those who can pay and those who are full freight? I mean, not any freight. You know, you're giving them scholarships. So if you're going to do this kind of thing, and then you need numbers. So are you going to reduce and standards so that you get the numbers you need to make this work? I see this anyway. Those are the questions. Those are the worries. It doesn't look like an asterisk really does this. You probably need several asterisks.
So, Mark or David, just chime in.
I think that the admissions thing, that's something, a detail, I hate to call it a detail, that the proposal did not include, but yet again, that's certainly a problematic thing. And the mix of people, part of the underlying question of that, I think that people were thinking about is the same kind of question that Richard just raised about, you know, are we going to have different standards for folks who can pay or folks who can't pay? And I think that was a concern, implicit concern in EPC's discussion.
Mark? Yeah, I would reflect that quality of education and scaling were where those topics came up.
Okay, we have a in-person, identify yourself and your department.
I am Walker White from Computer Science. I don't know if either of you can answer this, but we do actually have a significant non-traditional presence here at Cornell. It's called employees that do the continuing education program. I've had them in my courses all the time. If we make a program like this, is this going to cause Cornell to shunt them into this program as opposed to away from the traditional courses that they're in right now?
We're different heights. So I can say that when this was being considered, I shared with the University Assembly, which has both the Student Assembly, Graduate Student Assembly, and the Employee Assembly. I mentioned the program and that this conversation has started, and they were enthusiastic. Okay. So the Employee Assembly, they were like, can we join in? So thus far.
My question is, because this is asynchronous, does this deny them the ability to take the classes in person, right? Because they had to jump through hoops with their supervisor. Is this an argument for the supervisor to deny them the in-person class now if we have something like this?
Excellent question, in my opinion.
Mark, any comments?
No, it's been a while since I read it, and we had our discussion back before, back kind of late in the fall. My recollection was it did not affect the current employee program, but I'd have to go back and look at that.
Okay, we're over time, but I'd like to take one more question and then maybe make it up on one of the other topics. Zoom, Laurent Dubreuil.
Thank you. So briefly, I would say that I applaud the goal or the ambition there. I taught in prison when I was in my 20s. One of my doctoral degrees was from a university that was based on the idea that non-traditional students should be able to graduate. But on the basis of what I heard and what I read from the two committees, I would say that this looks like, as it is, as a way to sell the brand, the Cornell brand, and award an inferior degree in the closed circuit system in terms of financing, looks rather like a shameful ploy to use a kind of charitable or goal and social diversity idea as a facade to have students who would pay full price, relatively low level degree. So again, based on the information I have, from the reports and from what you both said, it looks like a very, very bad idea as it is now.
Comments? David or Mark?
I think the only thing I would say is I think the proposal was written in a way to answer the question of why would we do this, and it was knowingly short on the how. I know for the CAP committee, you know, we wanted to recognize that in the feedback that we were providing, that we recognize the why is solid. That answer makes sense to all of us. The how, the devil's in the details, and there are a lot of concerns, and that should be treated really carefully in terms of specifying it out if it's going to move forward.
I've been told that people are asking for more time for this discussion. I welcome you to give feedback on the website for today's Senate meeting. I would love for this dialogue to continue, and so and we can bring it. We actually are bringing it back to the Senate because the Finance Committee and the Academic Freedom and Professional Status of Faculty Committees also have the report under consideration. So it will be back in March, and we'll continue the conversation. But please put your comments in writing online. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on to the discussion of new Research Administration Support System, RASS, with a presentation by Miles Gideon, manager of the Institutional Review Board, IRB, 5 minutes. Is Miles online? Unmute yourself, if so.
I am. Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm here. So thanks for having me. I know I only have a few minutes, so I'll go quickly. My name is Miles. I'm the manager of the IRB administrative team within the Office of Research Integrity and Assurance. And I just wanted to share briefly about our new online system that launched last week. Next slide, please. So RAS stands for Research Administration Support Systems. For those of you who have sponsored research, you may already know RAS from the grants and contracts portion, but we now have a new section, a new module for Institutional Review Board Human Participant Research Projects. There will be other modules up there within the coming years as well, but we're excited to be there for now. So for those of you who conduct human participant research, we have been using Word and PDF fillable forms for far too many years. So this is a much needed upgrade to an online system where we have a smart form and a clear transparent workflow where everything is just entered by the researcher on this webpage, and they'll get to see what's happening with the IRB review process, correspond with the IRB committee members and administrative staff through this online portal and receive their approvals that way as well. So everything is in one place instead of sort of all over the place as it's been. And we're very excited about that. And another really nice connection, of course, is that the IRB protocols that are funded externally will have a nice close connection with the sponsored proposals and awards, which are also in RAS. Next slide. So just briefly about the functionality. Researchers can create all sorts of protocols of various types all through the same smart form. The system has logic built in, so it will ask questions that will help the researcher lead to various outcomes. So for collaborative research, for example, where the researcher is actually requesting that Cornell's IRB relies on another IRB, that type of a reliance agreement protocol can be created in the same place as a full-blown IRB protocol. And the system has an auto-determined review type ability, which I think is really neat. And all subsequent submissions related to those protocols will happen within the same protocol record, which is also different than before. So amendments are basically just editing the existing approved protocol, and there's version control. I did want to note that all active protocols that were processed in our old system and through our old forms have been migrated to RAS, but it's primarily metadata. So we've been trying to communicate with our researchers about this for a couple of months now. But the first time that a researcher comes into RAS IRB to amend their existing protocol, there will be a number of fields that look like they're empty. And so that first time they come in, they will need to spend some time filling in the gaps of what the existing approved protocol is. And we have a variety of ways to support people on that, which I'll get to in another slide or two. Next slide, please. So just really quickly, I wanted to show you what it looks like. As you see, the IRB module is right next to grants and contracts. It's on the same platform. It's nice and clean and neat. Next slide. In terms of that training and support, our IT staff have been wonderful and created a whole bunch of step-by-step written how-to documents to guide researchers through various parts of the process, different tasks within the system, from finding a protocol that already exists to responding to IRB review comments. We've conducted a few Zoom training sessions already, and we have recordings of those on our website. We're hosting, for now, at least twice weekly IRB, RAS IRB specifically, office hours through Zoom. And our staff are available for additional training and support as needed. There's a website called the RAS Guide site where all of this how-to and support documentation and, all of this documentation is available. Next slide. So this is what that RAS Guide site looks like, and you'll see there are other parts of it, not just IRB, but if you click on that IRB tab at the top, next slide, you'll see what it looks like. You have all of those how-to documents as well as a link to those Zoom trainings and basically as much information as we hope will be useful. Next slide. So we have two email addresses. One is system-related questions. One is just basically reaching the IRB staff. So those are listed here. We have a webpage where we've been giving a bunch of information over the past couple of months about our transition. So I wanted to include that link as well. And last but not least, the last slide, please. Just noting that these are my sort of colleague functional teams within ARIA. I wanted to include those websites as well for those of you who may be interested. Thanks so much.
Presentation of the new external contracts addendum, and maybe 8 minutes for Senate discussion after that to make up some time. I have two people listed, Mark Hurwitz and Robert Hoon, presumably both online.
Yeah, we're both here, and I'll talk us through the addendum, and Rob will correct me if necessary. Okay, so, excuse me, let's just go on to the next slide. And let me get things out of my way here. So we have new federal requirements for sponsored research that are going to, this trend I think is probably going to continue. There's a lot of national security concerns related to foreign influence, and there are concerns related to basically double dipping external contracts, contracts for the same kind of research not being recorded through the normal channels. NSF requires all PIs to identify all their current and pending projects, regardless of the source of funding. So not just their sponsored projects, anything. NIH is requiring external foreign contracts related to research to be uploaded to the NIH for their review. So a foreign entity is any organization or its representatives with headquarters outside the U.S., foreign subsidiaries or subsidiaries of foreign parent companies. An external contract is anything that's not part of faculty members' Cornell employment duties. Next slide. So the reason we need a contract addendum is to make sure that all contracts that are not vetted through Cornell in the normal way recognize that faculty have pre-existing and primary employment obligations to Cornell, that faculty have federal disclosure and regulatory obligations, that a consulting contract or other external contract with a different entity may trample on, may not recognize. And so the addendum simply makes sure that the faculty member is not inadvertently violating any of their obligations. And it allows us to avoid doing something more invasive, such as scrutinizing contracts and participating in the development of external contracts, which nobody wants, we don't want to do. And so having this addendum will provide the protection that's necessary and will not cause any hiccups in any kind of normal contracting arrangement. So I did, one of the notes got cut off. It's important to note that while Cornell Medicine already requires all external contracts to include the addendum and to be retained by the college, the addendum has been used by Ithaca faculty for quite some time now in whenever they ask for a review by council to help them with a contract. And I honestly forget what the last note was, but go on to the next one. Next slide, please. Yep. Okay. So how can you be trampling on pre-existing obligations? You by entering into external employment or consulting arrangements, which you are by rights allowed to do, it can raise many issues. And some of these are real or perceived conflicts of interest or commitment, that possibly problems with federal funding disclosures, because, for instance, if NIH is reading your contract and it has something untoward in it, that could be a problem. Their commercial entities are constantly trying to grab onto as much IP as they can. If you don't review your contract very, very carefully, you may find that you're giving away Cornell IP, which puts the researcher, you, in an awkward situation. And export control, regardless of whether, you know, that applies to all citizens of the United States. And you really don't want to enter in a contract that doesn't explicitly agree that it's going to abide by export control law. So you can move on. Yeah. And it's not, this isn't complicated. The addendum itself is one page. It was, I believe, included in the materials for this meeting. And it just briefly states facts. You know, it does not go into any details about the particular contract. It just says, these are things that need to be paid attention to and have to be agreed to by the both sides of the contract. Next slide, please. Okay. So it's hard to write out all the cases in which the contract is absolutely needed. And this presentation is part of starting to socialize the idea, but we have come up with a list of exceptions. And these are the things that absolutely you do not need to put the addendum in your contract. We're not addressing part-time faculty at this time. It may be that that'll happen in the future, but most part-time faculty have large external commitments, and we don't want to cause problems in any of that. Contracts unrelated to your work for the university. It actually came up a question of, I'm using my house as an Airbnb. Do I need the addendum in that? Absolutely not. Contracts with Cornell or its units, like sponsored research, anything that goes through Cornell to get approved, these issues are taken care of. You don't need this. This would be a redundant piece of the contract for those cases. Traditional scholarship activities are things that you know Cornell has no rights in, such as your publishing agreements, any book deals that you want to make, uses of your educational materials. We have nothing to do with that. And although consulting and being an expert in some cases, in most cases, does require the addendum, if you're serving as a consultant or an expert witness in litigation, no, you do not need the addendum. Next slide. Okay, the question has come up a lot that, are we going to have problems with corporations accepting this addendum? And the answer is no, because it's a statement of fact. There's nothing in the addendum that can be disputed by any other party. So this is a set of examples of organizations that have had no trouble accepting the addendum. And next slide. And so we're expecting to update the faculty handbook and have this all settled in May. today we're introducing it to the Faculty Senate. We're going to spend March and April answering questions that arise from the Senate and other parties. Hopefully use that to create a set of frequently asked questions to go up on the web page with the addendum itself, and get it all done by May. And I believe that's it.
Okay, we've eaten up a lot of time on that presentation, but I will accept some questions from the in-person or Zoom audience if I see any hands raised, which I don't yet. We have an in-person, so since there's nobody in Zoom, introduce yourself and your department affiliation.
Thank you. I'm Buzz Bostow from Biological and Environmental Engineering. Less of a specific question and more of like a sort of an overview question about research administration and the administrative burden on research. What are we, if anybody could speak to it, what are we doing to reduce the administrative burden on faculty? This seems like it's adding to it. We know already that it's a significant problem. More and more of our time is getting eaten up with paperwork. Less and less is being put.
I can address that. Actually, we are very aware of that. We're trying to take on as more of the administrative burden and not burden faculty any more than absolutely necessary. The addendum is sort of a compromise between having faculty review their external contracts. We don't want to do that. We just want to provide a simple and clear means of dealing with this new scrutiny from the federal sponsors. Okay, so one of the things that's happening is that the sponsors of research are demanding more and more. We are trying to keep up with that and trying to take on as much of the burden as we can. And we think this addendum is a very simple way to reduce that worry about the federal sponsors and what they're demanding with respect to external contracts. We could go on in other areas, and I'd be happy to talk to you about that, but I don't think we have the time for it in this discussion.
Well, Mark, the only thing I might add is that, again, this is outside of your Cornell course and scope of responsibility. So this is external consulting, advising board service on your 20% time that usually implicates, questions about conflict of commitment, et cetera. So in the absence of the addenda, what you'll do is inadvertently agree to terms that actually trample on your pre-existing obligations to either the feds or to Cornell. So this keeps everybody, this true ups those agreements, regardless of what they say, so that we reconcile those conflicting or contraindicated causes.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I think we need to move on to the next order of business. We have two proposal presentations. The first, a 10-minute presentation with 10 minutes of Senate discussion after that on the question of a new nanatorium in the Do the Greatest Good capital campaign. Senator Ashley Newman, Department of Population Medicine and Diagnostic Sciences. 10 minutes, presumably from Zoom.
Yes, I am here. Thank you. Next slide, please. So I want to start off with the reality that unless we act now, Cornell will be without a functioning pool. Sorry, my screen just changed on me. Sorry. Thanks. The Cornell pools have a finite lifespan that's estimated to end in 2025, and the process of construction, planning of a new pool would take at least 10 years. So we have a time gap problem. Therefore, the goal of this resolution is to provide facts on the current state of the pools and implore the administration to act and make a new natatorium a priority. Next slide, please. You may be asking yourself, why should I care? This is a varsity problem, or I don't swim. Well, you may be interested to know that 742 faculty, staff, and retirees swam in open swim in 2018 to 2019, and that's the last year that we have complete data prior to the COVID shutdowns. 1,875 students swam during open swim in that time. And then you have an additional approximately 600 students that are a part of the variety of these groups listed here. My personal connection to this issue is that I swam growing up my entire life. I was a four-year varsity swimmer at Cornell and co-captain in my senior year. I happened to meet my husband while I was swimming at Cornell, and he is now the head coach of the team. And I believe in the benefit of swimming. Next slide, please. The benefits of aquatic exercise certainly are physical in nature, but also certainly in regards to mental health. It's been shown that swimming improves self-esteem in college students and is a preventative measure to combat depression, winter blues, and the more severe seasonal affective disorder. And I'll be coming back to this later in the presentation. Next slide. The existing pools at Cornell are Teagle Hall, which is imaged above, as well as Helen Newman Hall, imaged below. Teagle was built in 1951 as the male-only athletic facility, and Helen Newman was built as the female-only athletic facility. And due to these gender-specific construction, even with the modifications that have made since then, they have inadequate bathrooms and showers for the opposite gender, but as well for transgender and gender non-conforming persons. In addition, the pools are also not handicap accessible. Next slide. So what are the other issues facing our pools? Well, we have an imbalance in supply and demand. There's a large demand on pool times, all the groups that I listed in that first slide, as well as groups that can't get pool time because there's not enough hours in the day and space. The pools are aged and failing. And therefore, the swimming pool turnover rate, for example, is the amount of time it takes for all the water in the pool to go through the filtration system. And that is far longer than what it needs to be based on the high usage of the pools. This has been a contributor to poor water quality. It's been cloudy and it's been unsafe to swim in. And that's resulted in an increased frequency in pool closures that have started around 2019. Teagle Hall also needs a new roof, and that has been estimated to cost between $10 and $12 million. The entire roof structure has asbestos material, and so when there's been leaks, that is certainly a problem. So the pools are 71 and 59 years old, and they have had all the improvements that can be done to prolong their life, and that's estimated at an additional 5 years in 2025. That money that was spent in 2020 actually included structural support, and that includes wooden beams that were placed underneath the pools to help hold them up because they were engineeringly not sound. And the decision was made to use wood beams instead of steel beams, for example, to save money because it wasn't going to be worth the investment to pay for steel when the pools themselves wouldn't last as long as the steel beams would. The process of approval, fundraising, planning, and construction can take up to 10 years. Therefore, even if we started today with this process, that would put us at 2032 and a potential 7-year time gap where we would have no pools on campus. Next slide. I've been asked in discussions with multiple people, why does Cornell need a 50-meter pool? Why not save money and build a 6-lane, 25-yard pool similar to what we already have? And the short answer is that it would not solve the supply and demand issue that we have at Cornell. I have two examples of our peer institution pools listed here. Above is Princeton, built in 1990, and below is Brown's pool, built in 2012. Both of these 50-meter pools have what we call bulkheads, which are placed perpendicular to the length of the 50-meter distance. And what that allows for is the ability to quarantine off the pool into multiple sections. And therefore, you can have, for example, a PE class happening in one area, open swim happening in one area, and then down in the diving well, diving practice or scuba diving class, all at the same time. So you're increasing the number of groups that can use the pool at one time, as well as giving them more optimal hours of availability. Next slide. You may say that schools like Princeton and Brown have larger endowments. They can afford a pool like this, and we can't. Well, if we look at our New York peer institutions, Ithaca College image there and Colgate University, both pools have a 50-meter pool with the ability to have bulkhead separation that we talked about. And you may be interested to find out that both pools were funded by help from Cornell alumni. It's also interesting to note, some people say, well, we don't need a big or as nice of a pool as IC. And I would argue that we certainly do, because Cornell has 2.5 times more faculty than IC and 4.5 times more students. Next slide. A Cornell university without a pool would be simply an embarrassment. We would be the only Ivy League, non-Ivy League peer, regional college university without one. Many community colleges, including TC3, have a pool. Without a pool, that would mean the termination of all aquatic activities that I previously listed, including beginning swimming at Cornell, in which people of color consist of 89.7% of enrolled students. It's been shown that participation in formal swimming lessons reduces drowning risk, and we know that people of color are at a disproportionate risk of drowning than white people, and this is largely due to an unequal access in swimming lessons. Next slide. Beginning swimming at Cornell has high praise in course evaluations from students. One student said, "I left the course gaining a whole new life skill. I had a few traumatic experiences with drowning as a child and never thought I would be able to learn how to swim." One student actually wrote a column in the Cornell Daily Sun arguing against the swim test, only to then enroll in beginning swimming, learn how to swim, and then write a retraction column about her changed perspective. Next slide. In 2020, Cornell published its Mental Health Review final report, and it stated what we know, that Cornell is a culture of competition that may take on an unhealthy cycle of expectation and behavior that can reach traumatizing levels for students, faculty, and staff. It was important to note that when asked for their recommendations, undergraduate, graduate, and professional students consistently prioritize the need for access to free physical fitness opportunities to cope with stress and build resilience. And with Ithaca's climate, students want free and convenient indoor fitness options. It's important to note that swimming at Cornell is a free activity, unlike using any of the fitness centers on campus, which require a paid membership. I was thrilled to read the recommendation then under well-being to prioritize fundraising for free physical fitness under affordability within the capital campaign, to then only read below that virtual fitness classes and virtual and augmented reality proposed in lieu of a fitness center. And I think it goes without stating that there is no virtual equivalent for any aquatic activity, and I certainly can't swim in my living room. Next slide. A new auditorium would therefore do an enormous amount of good, benefiting students, faculty, staff, and retirees' physical and mental health. Despite talks of a new pool at Cornell since the 1980s and pools that could fail at any time, a new auditorium is still not a university priority item and is not included in the capital campaign. The capital campaign is the only way to prevent Cornell from having to pay for the entire project in the event of a catastrophic failure of both pools. Therefore, we're asking for the ability to reach major donors across all of Cornell with the assistance of Alumni Affairs and Development to try and make this project a reality. Next slide. I would like to thank the fellow co-sponsors of this resolution that I have listed here, as well as thank the support of the Faculty Advisory Committee on Athletics and Physical Education. Next slide. And I have the entire resolution here that we can certainly leave up during the discussion. But one thing I want to highlight is really, we feel that it's important to provide an inviting, modern, safe, and accessible environment for aquatic activities to provide Cornell students, faculty, and staff the ability to exercise year-round, which is a proven positive contributor to mental health. Thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
If there's anyone in person, come up to the microphone. If you're on Zoom, please raise your digital hand. We're going to take a question or comment from Richard Bensel on Zoom, and then we have an in-person.
I'll be really brief. I strongly support this. I'm appalled that that the central administration has not planned ahead to resolve this problem of the pool. And I think that's something that should be taken into account. We're playing catch up, but I think an excellent idea, excellent proposal. Appreciate it. I mean, it's a very strong presentation.
Thank you.
Go ahead in person and identify yourself.
Buzz Basto, Biological and Environmental Engineering. Thank you so much for your presentation regarding this. I think it really laid out the arguments in favor of a new swimming pool really, really coherently. When I first read the resolution over email a few days ago, my initial response to it was very negative. I used Teagle and Newman almost every day when I was a grad student here. They're kind of depressing, but I think, you know, exercising every day made me a better person. But despite that, you know, my initial response to it was, you know, isn't this just another luxury amenity? And I worry deeply that we spend way too much money on amenities. We don't spend enough of it on our core mission. But in discussion with my colleagues in BEE, I think my skepticism about this has been reversed. And so I want to say, I think a lot of my colleagues are very much in favor of this, and I really recommend it.
Thank you. We have a Zoom, Courtney Roby. Unmute yourself.
Yes, thank you very much. I mean, actually, that was a great presentation. I think you did make a very strong case for the value of pools. At the same time, I guess I'm mindful of President Pollack's visit, where she described the priorities of the current capital campaign as being staffing. And I think that we've all felt, even before the pandemic, that there were staffing shortages at almost every level of the university. And since the pandemic, it's just been exacerbated. So I guess, you know, this, I'm afraid, is a classic, more of a comment than a question. I just, you know, cannot quite get my mind away from thinking about the shortages in hiring new staff that might result from diverting spending to the pools. But I agree, it would, in an ideal world, be great if we had better pools.
Thank you. Also online, Beth Millis.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to provide a comment, and I thought about it. First of all, that was a fantastic presentation, and I feel like the moment we're living in, it's so obvious that it, although it might seem like a luxury to look at things like mental wellness and the accessibility of mental health in swimming, is just something I don't want to overlook. So I fully support the proposal. And my anecdote is that I went to Cornell undergrad in the 80s and discovered swimming when I didn't think I was a person who could exercise. And since I was 19 years old, I've been swimming a mile every day, and it's changed my life, and nobody believes it. And it's like something I've held onto in the pandemic. And I teach this to my students as well as the performing arts, that our wellness is so important. So I fully support it. And I thank you for the presentation. I agree that hearing what you had to say in person was very compelling. Thank you.
Abby Cohn, online.
Hi, Ashley, it was a terrific presentation. And as you know, I strongly support the resolution. I think, to me, one of the issues is we often think there's a zero-sum game when we're doing fundraising, and I just don't think that's true. I think what's gone on, for example, with the tech campus has shown that. You know, that was a big fear that we all had. And I think what we're really asking for is access to alums and to potentially major donors just to make the pitch, really. And you've done, I think, a beautiful job here. And I think what we're really asking is, can we articulate this need and concern to a broader audience? There, you just never know who's out there who might be interested. I also think, you know, we have a way of fundraising at Cornell where we focus primarily on major donors. And it's absolutely the case for a project this big that we would need a major anchor donor to start fundraising. But I also think there's a lot of room for crowdsourcing. And my own vision is that we could each buy a tile. You know, we'll have this beautiful new pool and we can have a wall of tiles that speaks to how many of us have been touched by swimming and how critically important we consider this to be.
Thank you. Risa Leibowitz.
Yeah, thank you. Risa Leibowitz, ILR. So I'm certainly in support of having a good pool. But I was thinking, based on what Courtney Roby had said more broadly, about fitting these issues into a broader context of the importance of expression, physical expression, artistic expression, including swimming, including dancing, including music, you know, all of those things that are so important to make life worth living and to take care of our mental and physical and emotional health. And it made me think about the cuts that occurred, I don't remember what year it was, to the performing arts program and the cuts that were made in the dance program, which affected me a lot because I relied on the dance program very much for the joy of taking those classes. And so it seems to me it would be a really good idea to think kind of holistically about those sorts of programs and how do we join together to support those as a whole, as opposed to, you know, only the pool separated from the benefits of the ways in which these other activities are as important, not a competition between the two, but that also implicate those questions of staffing and you know, academic programs.
Absolutely. I'll just comment if I can. I actually grew up dancing as well. And one thing to Abby's point is we simply just want the opportunity to ask, to get this out to donors that may not even know this is a need and that we may have a Cornell with no pools. And unfortunately, a pool is just such an expensive item. A dance studio with floor and mirrors is just less expensive. And all of the other fitness centers on campus have had upgrades in recent years and have been brought up more to modern standards. And we're kind of just asking to include these into bringing them up to this day and age and making them safe and accessible.
Thank you. We have another 20 minutes on a related question on the swim test requirement. 5 minutes from the Faculty Advisory Committee on Athletics and Physical Education, then 5 minutes from Ryan Lombardi, student in campus life, and then 10 minutes for discussion. So I'm not exactly sure who's talking on behalf of the Faculty Advisory Committee on Athletics and Physical Education. Make yourself available in person and identify yourself.
I'm Frank Rossi. I'm an associate professor of horticulture in the School of Integrated Plant Science in Cal. How's that? Okay, great. Sorry about that. Okay. And I think we've got some slides to present. I'm chair of the Faculty Advisory Committee on Athletics and Phys Ed. I've been on the committee for about 12 years. I've presented to the Faculty Senate on a number of issues before. It's sort of ironic we're proposing it the night of the pool, which is very interesting. And I know Ryan appreciates the irony of that as well. So let me start with the slides. I believe there's some slides in the deck. Thank you very much. You know, this was started as long as Cornell is old. Something because around the idea that it was related to preventable deaths. Drowning was a significant cause of unintentional death in the United States. There's CDC reports that 10 people die every day from drowning. And there was this thought at Cornell that it was something, and it comes right out of the resolution that created the swim test, that we make it a life skill, it will then be something that our Cornell students won't struggle with. So that was the original rationale when whoever started the whole thing got us into this mess. That was what they were well-intentioned, I guess we would say that. I'll take the next slide. So like all of us, the best data we've got probably that's useful is the most pre-COVID, right? So big shout out to Jen Gudaz, one of our associate athletic directors in the athletic department that oversees the pool, is a certified pool operator and all the wonderful things. We are fortunate to have experts. A dilapidated pool system usually needs people like that to keep them running. So this is our data from the last couple of years. For the freshmen that are required to take the test, out of the gate, you can see the numbers are pretty significant. But overall, about 2,800 kids pass a test, and we have about a 0.6 to 0.7% fail rate of the ones that take it. And then presumably, they're going into swim lesson. And then there's people who go directly into the swim PE class. So I'll have the next slide. If you don't take it your freshman year, apparently we got to pay $100. It's not a big revenue stream for the university, I don't imagine, but they've made a couple of bucks on it. But it generally is less than 10% of the swim tests that are administered by, let me say, a well-oiled machine over at the pools. In fact, I'll just depart and tell a story. Jen Gudaz and Dutch before her, who oversaw this for, I don't want to say 100 years, but pretty darn close to 100 years, would describe times where she would work with people at other Ivies, University of Arizona, University of California, Davis, to get our kids to pass the tests remotely, right? So I want to just let you know that this is a well-oiled machine that's been underway for a really long time, and they know what they're doing. And you can see the numbers of failures or money things, the data reflects that. Next slide. So here's the data that I was asked to provide by the leadership of the Faculty Senate. We're so glad we asked this question. I commend Ryan for asking it, us for pursuing it. I think it fosters good conversation about something that's not so clear-cut, can be looked at from multiple perspectives, particularly through the lens, a DEI lens. These are the students in fall of 19 and 18 that enrolled in the beginning swimming class, presumably because they were not confident or failed the swim test. So you can see that, as was indicated by an absolutely spectacular presentation by Ashley Newman, I will say, represents the underrepresented minorities and women that are in this class. The data really speaks for itself. It's really overwhelmingly saying these are the people who, when they get there, say, all right, I got to learn how to swim. So the next slide then talks about some of the other accommodations we make for this. And again, not to minimize them all, but in the scheme of 2,800 tests, to have four that were had to go through this process, I really think speaks to the fact that this actually working pretty good as it's been designed to do. It does raise the question, I think, that I was asked early on. That data shows clearly it's women and underrepresented minorities that have to learn to swim when they get here. I think that might be it. There might be one more. Yep, that's it. So thank you very much, and we'll just save discussion for the end.
And is Ryan Lombardi speaking?
I am. Thank you.
Okay.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right, terrific. Thanks, everyone. Good afternoon. Pleased to be with you today. Next slide. With my colleague Frank, really eager to be here to just ask this question of the Faculty Senate for a perspective on whether or not passing a swimming test should continue to be a condition of graduation from Cornell. And I'll frame why I think we ask that question now after a 2-year pause given COVID of administering this test. I think it's always wise to think critically about the things we have in place. I don't hope to intend whether or not swimming is a valuable life skill. I fully agree it is. I think I swam before I walked and certainly swam better before I walked well. Next slide. So the history, a little more detailed, is instituted in 1905 for men to prepare them to be effective soldiers. This is a time when military drill was also required, and instituted in 1920 by the first woman director of sports and PE. But as I understand it, and according to page 77 of the faculty handbook, the university faculty ultimately established these two universal requirements, both the swim test and the PE, the two semesters of physical education, which is why we thought it would be good to bring this to the Faculty Senate, since it derived from the faculty as well. Next slide. We are one of three Ivies that maintains this requirement. I think a lot of the Ivies had it back in the day. There are three remaining Ivies, including us and Columbia and Dartmouth. Next test, or next slide. In addition to the test, students do have to complete two physical education courses over the course of their time as undergraduates. They choose from nearly 50 options, a wide variety of classes you might expect. Some of the typical ones and some that you might not expect, like meditation and yoga and things like that. Next slide. As Frank indicated, drowning is a leading cause of unintentional death, according to the CDC. This gives you a little perspective on that frame, the density of that, the intensity of that against other common causes of unintentional death. Next slide. As Frank also said, students are encouraged to complete this test during their first year of enrollment, and frequent clinics are offered to make sure that that can happen. Next slide. Currently, transfer students are not required to complete the swim test, so this is only for students who matriculate as first-time new undergraduate students at Cornell. Next slide. So this has been paused since March 2020. You can expect why we had to pause this requirement when we effectively sent all students home. We have not yet restarted it because every semester we've begun, we weren't sure if we were going to be able to continue that semester given the roller coaster of COVID that we've been on. But it is our intention to resume the administration requirement this coming fall of 2022. Next slide. You already heard about the accommodations data. Just 4 exemptions have been granted over those preceding years prior to the COVID pause. Next slide. And students who do not pass or want to learn to swim prior to enrolling this beginning swimming class, as Frank mentioned, course evaluations are positive. Even Professor Newman referenced this. Students cite high quality of instruction, increased levels of comfort, all the good things. Next slide. To underscore Frank's point, if you look at the 3 semesters of cumulative enrollment preceding the COVID pause, there is a disproportionate number of students of color and of women that enroll in PE 1000. If you break this out, domestic versus international students, the numbers go up slightly. If you look at only domestic students, they go down modestly if you look at international students. Next slide. So this data does underscore a perception that my colleagues and I have heard that this requirement disproportionately impacts students of color. And our staff do report anecdotes in our interactions with students that this is an added stress, is perceived to be an added stress for some students of color. So in summary, next slide. Swim test has been around, as Frank said, for many, many years, more than 100. It is unquestionably a valuable life skill. We know that about 88% of our undergraduates have to go through this when we take out our transfer students, since they're not currently required. And we know that women and students of color take PE 1100 at very high rates. And we experience that the swim test may be perceived as an added hurdle for our students of color. Last slide. So again, here really just to get feedback and ask the question, I look forward to and appreciate the work of the FACAPE and plan to continue discussions with Frank and his committee subsequent to this meeting to determine what, if any, future adjustments might be made or not. So I appreciate hearing any feedback. I know Frank would be glad to answer questions as well.
Thank you. If there's anyone in person with a comment or question, come to the microphone. If you're on Zoom, raise your hand. We have a person?
No, I was going to, if there was a question, you needed me to answer.
Okay. I'm not seeing any raised hands. I'll wait just a few seconds more. Kent Hubble, online.
Kent Hubble.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Am I on?
Yes.
Okay. Well, some of you know me as having been the Dean of Students from 2001 to 2015, and I certainly see the value of having all students learn to swim, but the anxiety and the pain and the difficulty that small number of students who failed the test and had phobic reactions to swimming made me very concerned about having it as a requirement, especially one attached to academic performance in the form of graduation. So while I urge all students to be able to swim, I'm reluctant to support the notion that it become a requirement for graduation. I think that that's more than we should expect from our students and from the institution.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Over here.
Thank you very much. I'm Buzz Bostow, Biological and Environmental Engineering. I actually want to offer a counterpoint opinion to that. I can completely accept the arguments for removing the swim test requirement. But I think that there's, from my own perspective, there's value in taking people outside of their comfort zone, and learning to operate outside of your comfort zone, I think, is an extremely valuable skill that we've got to teach our students. It could be in the form of a swim test. It could be in the form of a 5-mile run. It could be something else. But I can't overstress how valuable I think that experience is, no matter what physical or mental form it takes.
Thank you. Ashley Newman.
So Just a quick comment. I would say that I'm in support of continuing the swim test. I think that it's important to note that the beginning swimming PE credit still counts towards the graduation physical education requirement that all undergraduate students have to do. So at least all students have to do PE class, and by taking beginning swimming, it still fulfills that graduation requirement that all students have. And that's it.
Yuval Grossman, online.
Hi. So actually, I have more of a question. So what is our role here? I mean, are we going to have a vote, or is it just that people are about to just spend? Just you want to hear what we are saying? And I don't know if the question is to Ryan or to Frank.
I don't want to, if Frank's coming up, I don't want to step. I think that any action would come out of FACATE subsequent to this conversation. So I think this is more about us hearing feedback so that the committee that Frank chairs can determine whether to take action. Frank, is that accurate?
100%. Yeah, that's what I figured. I think this thing got a little bit of a life of its own. And I think working through the committee is probably the best way now. To retrench. But I do think we should hear from everybody. I mean, that's what we gather to do here, right? So I think, Ryan, I'm with you 100%, Ryan. We should hear from people. But and we'll come back and craft something that maybe will become a resolution.
Yeah, so let me say, like, my personal view. Of course, I truly believe that, know how to swim is a great thing. But my general approach, and I think it's not only for this test, I very general belief that we put much too many requirements on our students. And that include, you know, so many things that we put on the orientation and everything. So my general approach is the minimal requirement is actually the best for our students.
Thank you. Wendy Wilcox.
Thanks. First, I just want to emphasize that I do agree with Alex Nading's point on chat that students of color and first-gen students already have many experiences outside of their comfort zone, so I don't think that should be a motivating factor. Second, on your data, if I remember correctly, the number of fails for the swim test were actually relatively low, so it wasn't clear to me. I don't recall seeing how many enrollments that number was related to that beginning swimming. So it says to me that maybe there's a disparity between actual people that fail the test versus people who enroll in the beginning swimming, which says to me that like it's not a significant number of people that are actually failing. So why do we have this arbitrary condition for graduation in place? If people want to take swimming as their PE, they have the opportunity. It's the PE requirement itself is a part of graduation. That seems sufficient enough.
I believe there's between, and don't quote me on it. I know I'm going to get taped and recorded, and we'll come back and get you the specific numbers. Somewhere I remember the 80 to 100 kids enrolled in the swimming lessons class right out of the gate. That those numbers represent the percentage of. I think the slide might have an N value on it, but I don't know for sure. But to your point, it's a small number. It's not a big number. As you can see from the number of tests administered, pretty consistently every year, the majority of kids are getting it and passing it out of the gate.
Thank you. I'm going to go out of order since Abby has talked already. We'll get to her second. First, Debbie Cheney.
Hello, Debbie Cherney, Department of Animal Science. It does have something that kind of binds all the students, though. And the other thing is that the majority of people that are drowning are underrepresented minorities. So while it adds a little stress, it's kind of nice to think that we might be saving some of our alumni from drowning.
Thank you. Abby Cohen?
So I guess two things. One is procedurally, since this is a graduation requirement, I think that it would eventually have to go to the EPC and the EPC would have to bring it to us just procedurally. So I guess what I'm hearing, I agree with almost everything that's been said, but I think the question I'd like to ask or suggest is, it seems like the current mechanism to achieve the goal that we have all seemed to be in consensus about is not effective. So the question is, what is the alternative mechanism? What are we going to do instead to invite and encourage those individuals who would fail a swim test or who are not strong enough swimmers so that they really could be in a dangerous situation to see it as a life skill that we are endorsing and saying this is one of the things you should do at Cornell is gain this life skill? So I would like, I'm not opposed based on everything I've heard to us eliminating it, but I would like us to counterbalance that with a really proactive, thoughtful engagement with how are we going to achieve what we are not effectively achieving right now.
Thank you. I don't see any other hands up, so I think we can move on. Well,
sorry, Wendy, I just wanted to ask a follow-up question related to what Abby was saying. Because I know all these PE courses, there's an additional cost for everything that you register for. What's the additional cost for PE, the beginning swimming course?
Wendy, I'll just say, I don't know the answer to that, but I will say not all PE courses do have an additional cost. There are a number of PE courses that do not have a cost. I do not know, though, whether PE 1100 has an additional cost, but I will make sure to get that information.
Okay, we have good of the order, two speakers, and I think we can give them an extra minute each. Richard Bensel, government, on thoughts on the Faculty Senate agenda for 3 minutes, followed by Risa Lieberwitz on global hubs. So Richard, you're on.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm gonna take all that 3 minutes. I circulated a message to the senators and asked for feedback on a problem that faces the Faculty Senate. We've had a proposed resolution that was introduced September 17th, 2021. It's never been reported to the Senate. It's now 5 months and counting. This bottling up of faculty resolutions by the UFC, this is a serious problem. No democratic body could tolerate this kind of agenda control. The question is, what are we going to do about it? Those of you who are online who did not receive this message, let me know. And I'll send it to you. I'm always perfecting that list. Thank you.
Thank you. Risa?
Great, thank you. Risa Lieberwitz, ILR. So I wanted to talk about global hubs, but before getting into that, I just want to mention that I think it would be really good if when the Dean of Faculty gives announcements that we build in some time to have some discussion, questions and answers and discussion at that point, because I certainly would have been a good time to have raised the points that I'm now having to raise in the good of the order. So I hope we can do that in the future. But what I wanted to remind people of is that the Faculty Senate did pass a resolution and it passed on December 1st. The Senate voted in favor of a resolution to have faculty consultation in regard to global hubs. And in particular, in that resolution that was adopted on December 1st, it was proposed in November and then voted positively on and approved on December 1st. There was a specific, be it resolved, that asked CAP, the CAP committee, to report back to the Senate with regard to both the procedure that should be used with regard to approvals of the global hub and the role of the faculty, as well as the substantive criteria and standards that should be used in evaluating whether to approve global hubs. And we were told that CAP would report back in December to the Senate about that. Now, I understand that CAP's been busy, and I really appreciate the report that CAP made today with regard to the issue of the part-time program, proposed part-time program. And I think there's lots more to be said about that. So this is not a criticism of CAP. It's really a reminder that this is still an outstanding resolution that needs to be implemented. And from what I heard from the Dean of Faculty today, I did not hear with regard to what's coming to the Senate, a reference to CAP coming back to us to report on the procedure and the substantive criteria and standards for global hubs. So I wanted to raise that. And since I think I have time, I wanted to raise one other point, again, that I would have asked the Dean of Faculty had we had some time after her announcements. And that is that I think we're into nominations season with regard to elections for various openings. And that would include the faculty trustee, as well as the associate dean of faculty. And by my count, there's three UFC seats that would be filled through elections. And so I think it would be very helpful if we could know, as the faculty generally, and certainly the faculty senate, how to propose nominations and self-nominations. I hope that there would be a call, a general call to the faculty for nominations for these openings so that we can get a lot of input in that way, as well as directions of who to send those kinds of nominations and self-nominations to. So thank you very much.
Thank you. We have a couple of minutes. Eve, yes. DeRosa. Dean of Faculty.
I have 2 minutes, so I will try to address all of those. And Risa, I think that's a wonderful suggestion for me to give space for questions and answers for my announcements and updates. So I'm happy to build that into our Senate meetings going forward. Richard, I just wanted to say that of all the proposals that were pending from Charlie Van Loan as Dean of Faculty and then the three that were sent to me in September, there's only one that's outstanding, and that resolution's sitting with the new general counsel, and so she's working through the bylaws and wants to give feedback on it before taking it to the UFC. So it's been mentioned to the UFC, but they haven't had a chance to consider it yet because I've asked for the counsel to give feedback on bylaws and the implications for the bylaws. So it will come to us, just not yet. Risa, yes. So CAP, I think it was a little ambitious of me to promise CAP would be able to come to the Senate in December, 7 days after we passed it, to say that they know exactly how they're going to intersect with the International Council on Global Hubs. Mark Milstein, the chair of the Academic Programs and Procedures Policy, excuse me, committee, the CAP committee, is a voting member of the International Council, and all global hubs go through the International Council. So he is definitely part of it, and the idea that I brought up where the faculty members, as part of the salon, got too excited by two countries, those two countries would go to CAP, and those faculty members will present why they're excited about these hubs and what the implications are and how they will be implemented through the CAP, and CAP and these faculty members will come to the Senate. But I think the timeline is a lot slower than I anticipated. And so I can't promise when, but CAP will come back to the Faculty Senate with what they think are the correct implementations for how to consider the global hubs.
Thank you. It's 5:00. We are, by rule, adjourned.